let's start looking at some of these passages. One of our first topics here will be to learn how to read this sutta. Satipatthana Sutta. Because there's a lot of misunderstandings around what mindfulness means and what the sutta is actually telling you to do, what to do. Passage 1 there starts with an important principle. All dhammas are rooted in desire. Now, dhammas here means phenomena, just anything that comes up, anything that the mind takes as an object. Anything you experience counts as a dhamma. The only experience that does not count as a dhamma here is nirvana, non-binding. That's not rooted in desire. And in this way, the Buddha is pointing to the fact that everything you experience has an intentional element going into it. You're playing a role in how you experience in the world. This is related to those verses at the beginning of the Dhammapada where the Buddha says that all phenomena are preceded by the mind, has the mind in charge. Okay. What you're experiencing right now has an intentional element, and the intention is centered around a desire. A combination of past desires, which lead to the kind of karma you're experiencing, the results of the karma you're experiencing now, and your current desires. What do you want? What do you want out of this that you're looking at, you're listening to? And always keep that in mind, because there's not things don't just come. You're shaping them. You're shaping the raw material, and you're turning it into something. The whole purpose of this instruction is to help you shape it in a skillful way. They come into play through attention. In other words, there's a potential there for lots of things, and if you don't pay attention to it, it just goes. And when you pay attention, it becomes more solid. You can see this with pains in your body. If you pay attention, then all of a sudden, bang, they're a lot bigger. And if your attention is distracted, it seems like they're not there. Mm-hmm. So one of the main elements of your present input into things is your things that you decide to pay attention to. And again, your attention is driven by your desire. Either a desire for safety, a desire for pleasure, whatever. So think of your experience just as that, as lots of different potentials, and the potentials of some of them are going to grow because you pay attention to them. The Buddha's image is of a field full of seeds. And some of the seeds get watered and they grow, and other seeds don't get watered, they don't grow. Attention is one of the ways you water things. Among these other ones, I want to point out, I want to focus attention now on when all dhammas have mindfulness as their governing principle. As we'll find out, what this means is that the mindfulness, you've got to keep in mind something that, okay, certain things are skillful, certain things are not. And if something is skillful and you haven't given rise to it, then you do your best to give rise to it. And if something is unskillful, then you do your best to figure out how to get rid of it. In other words, mindfulness here is a factor of the memory. All dhammas gain the footing and the deathless. That's the image there is of someone crossing a stream. And as long as you're going across the deep part of the stream, you don't have a footing and you can get pushed around a bit. You finally reach a point of safety when you gain your first taste of awakening. And that's the point where your feet can reach the bottom of the other bank as you're getting out. You're not totally out of the stream yet, but you're on your way out, and you're a lot safer. You're not going to be blown, pushed around by the water so easily. And they have Nibbana as their final end. Nibbana is something that lies beyond dhammas entirely. It's not a regular experience like our normal experience. It's shaped by intention and desire. It's something that exists independently of these things. So all in all, this is a peculiar passage, but those are the points I felt were most important to point out. Release is the heartwood for all of this. This is the one thing where you have something that's solid. The image of heartwood It's the part of the tree that's the most solid and the most useful. And so what we're looking for is release, which comes through gaining a footing in the deathless and finally reaching nirvana. The main reason I included this passage is that very first sentence, all dhammas are rooted in desire. Because, okay, everything you're going to be doing here is rooted in a desire of some kind. And so you have to look around and say, okay, what are my desires? Do I have the desire to put an end to suffering, or do I have some few agendas first? And most of us will say, a few things I want to straighten out first, then we'll go for the end of suffering. This is probably why we're still here. So you have to keep coming back to that one point. What is my desire in this particular experience? Am I here to put an end to suffering, or do I want to do something else? If you decide, okay, I do want to put an end to suffering, then that's when you start working on the path. Any questions on that?
I do.
Yes.
I think at the really very basic level, if you could get me there, so any experience in any instant is somewhere the desire I had preceded it.
Or your desire right now.
Could you speak a little bit more then about, it sounds to me like, so therefore you would work to change your desire.
Right.
And that's what the frameworks are going to do?
That's what the frameworks are going to help you with. And it also reminds you that some of this stuff is based not on your desires right now, but past desires, mm-hmm. which you can't do anything about.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what my struggle is, so.
Okay, well, like, some point in some, before you were born, you had this, I'd like to be born as a human being. Mm-hmm. And you finally made it. Mm-hmm. And then you said, wait a minute, I didn't read the small print. You said, well, wait a minute, let's try something else this time. But then a lot of choices you make as you go through life. God, I want this, I want that, and you've acted on those desires. And some of these things are, you run up against possibilities that you would want, but you can't get them. And that again has to do with past desires, the karmic results of past things you did that act as blockades. Other things provide openings. There's an element of desire that shaped things that you're experiencing. And the reason our lives are so up and down is that we've had lots of different desires and acted on lots of different conflicting directions. And so part of the purpose of having a path is to kind of straighten things out. So, okay, let's get everybody working together. And so that means as you're working on the path, you still meet with some results of some past contrary desires that you're going to have to learn how to deal with. And also other new desires are going to come up, which will be contrary to the path. And you say, let's talk this over. I'll let them make charge. But so much is said about, you know, the Buddha says we suffer because of desire and therefore we should get rid of desire. Well, you get rid of desire by working first with skillful desires. So that becomes part of the path. So the whole purpose, the reason you're doing mindfulness practice is based on desire. So be clear about that fact. Because I have known some people who, especially when they do the kind of noting practice where you're not supposed to do anything at all, get catatonic. Because I'm not supposed to, you know, whatever comes up, I've just got to accept it. Some pretty bad stuff can come up. And if you're told not to do anything, you've been stripped of your tools. So you have to remember, okay, I'm here for a purpose, I've got a particular desire, and as John Cha says, you know, it's because of desire that you can tell that guy, I need the peel. Hold on to the peel as long as it serves its function, and then I'll let go. Yes?
Could you get into rooted in desire as opposed to having contact as their origination?
Okay, the desire actually comes before the contact.
It does.
Yeah. And that's the root is kind of underground. And then the contact is the point where it comes to the surface.
It comes to the surface.
Yeah.
Originates in the play of phenomena.
Right. Yes.
to experience desire, though, I'm trying to wrap that around before contact. Do you have to have something desiring? If that's the intellect, then you have intellect contact. I'm still confused about that.
There's something there that drives. It drives all this. And sometimes the desire isn't quite, it hasn't been clearly become something that you say, oh, this is the object of my mind. A lot of times it lies behind you.
That's a tough one.
It's a tough one. Well, again, it's going to be, even if it was an intellect contact before this intellect contact, still, that's having a huge shaping effect on both what's coming in to you and also what you're going to be looking for. You might say this is working on us as creatures that live in time. You know, contact doesn't come; it's not totally written down on a blank slate. Contact comes because we're sharks and we're out there trying to feed. To give you an image to keep in mind. Okay, now we're going to deal with this passage from the Satipatthana Sutta. The sutta starts with the Buddha giving a general introduction to the whole topic. What we've got here is that general introduction and then the passage on mental qualities, dhammas, in and of themselves. There's a lot in the introduction that we're going to have to go through very carefully. Okay, he starts out saying, this is the path going one way only, the purification of beings, the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, the disappearance of pain and distress, to the attainment of the right method, and the realization of unbinding. In other words, the four establishments of mindfulness. Sometimes you hear that very first phrase translated as this is the only way, which is not really what the Buddha is saying. The image of the word is polytermy as ekayana magga. And there's a passage where he actually talks about ekayana magga as being a path that leads to one direction, leads to one goal. It's not necessarily the only path there, but it goes that way, and there's no forks in the path. It's not going to pull you off someplace else. Then he gives you the definition of the four establishments. There's the case where you remain focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. You remain focused on feelings in and of themselves, mind in and of themselves, mental qualities in and of themselves, ardent, alert, mindful, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. Okay, that sets out the whole topic. And we're going to have to look into these adjectives, ardent, alert, and mindful, for a bit. But first, I want to just point out the fact that passage, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world, that's actually the function of the four frames of reference. These are the things you keep in mind so as to subdue greed and distress with reference to the world. Like when you're meditating, all of a sudden you have a desire for a new car. You say, I've got to subdue that greed again. And then you start thinking about, this is a hindrance. What to do with hindrances? And these are the hindrances to let go. How do I let go of them? I've got to develop some of these factors for awakening. So that's probably the function of this fourth frame of reference, is in that last part of the phrase, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. Now the qualities of ardency, alertness, and mindfulness, let's look down on passage 3. Page 7 of my printout. Passages 3, 4, and 5 discuss what it means to be ardent. So first, unarisen evil unskillful qualities arising in me would lead to what is unbeneficial. So you arouse ardency. Arisen evil unskillful qualities not being abandoned, you arise ardency. Unarisen skillful qualities not arising in me, you arouse ardency. Or arisen skillful qualities ceasing in me would lead to what is unbeneficial, you arouse ardency. This relates to right effort. These four qualities here, you know, if something is unarisen and evil, you do what you can to prevent it from arising. If something is unskillful and it has arisen, you try to abandon it. If something is skillful but it hasn't arisen, you try to give rise to it, and if it's already there, then you try to make sure that you maintain it. So basically, this is the quality of right effort. You don't just sit there watching things arise and pass anymore. You're trying to figure out, okay, what's going on in my mind? Is it something I should pursue? Is it something I should abandon? If I'm lacking something that's good, what can I do to give rise to it? So ardency is the active factor here. This is the factor that you do as you're going through the practice. Person without ardency, without compunction, is incapable of self-awakening, incapable of unbinding, incapable of attaining the unsurpassed safety from bondage. Or is a person ardent and compunctious? I had to search around for that action.
What does it mean?
Compunction is the quality when you say, I'd really like to do this, but you know, I know it's going to cause trouble down the line, so I'll not do it. That's compunction. There's some people translate it as moral dread, which I have a moral dread of myself. Excuse me? Otapa.
Otapa.
Otapa. Passage 5 is probably the most explicit one. If while he was walking there rises in a monk a thought of sensuality, a thought of ill will, a thought of harmfulness, and he does not quickly abandon, dispel, demolish, or wipe that thought out of existence, then he's in a monk walking with such lack of ardency and compunction is called continually and continuously lethargic and low in his persistence. But if while he was walking there arises in him a thought of sensuality, a thought of ill will, a thought of harmfulness, and he quickly abandons, dispels, demolishes, wipes that thought out of existence, the monk walking with such ardency and compunction is called continually and continuously resolute, one with persistence aroused. So this is the function of ardency in all of this. You recognize something's unskillful and you try to get rid of it. If it's skillful, you try to give rise to it. If it's there already, then you're trying to maintain it. So it's the effort part of the practice. Alertness, passage 6. It's a case where feelings are known to the monk as they arise, known as they become established, known as they subside. Same with thoughts and perceptions. And how is the monk alert in passage 7? When going forward and returning, he makes himself alert, when looking forward and looking away, when bending and extending his limbs, when carrying his outer cloak, his upper robe and his bowl, when eating, drinking, chewing, savoring, when urinating and defecating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and remaining silent, he makes himself alert. Another way of translating this is that he does this all alert with alertness. In other words, you know what you're doing while you're doing it. This is the factor that's related to the present of these three. Ardency is more a question of you're being related to the present and the future. You're trying to get rid of something because you know it's going to cause trouble if you don't. Or you're trying to give rise to something because you know it's going to be good for you if you do. So you have ardency, alertness, and then finally mindfulness itself. Passage 8. What is the faculty of mindfulness? There's a case where monk at Cyclone Noble once is mindful by meticulous remembering and able to call to mind even things that were done and said long ago. Remains focused on the body in and of itself. Basically, it's a quality of memory that you're keeping things in mind. And sometimes you hear about mindfulness as being an open and accepting awareness of whatever comes up. Well, passage 9 goes against that. Just as when a person whose turban or head was on fire would put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, earnestness, mindfulness, and alertness to put out the fire. In the same way, monks should put forth extra desire, effort, diligence, endeavor, relentlessness, mindfulness, and alertness for the abandoning of those unskillful qualities. So when your head is on fire, you don't just say, oh, there are yellow flames and there are red flames and there are blue flames. I say, I'm going to put these flames out. You know? And so mindfulness is one of the qualities that you bring to that. In other words, you, one, you remember this is something you want to do. Two, remember, how did I put it out last time? Let's use that.
May I ask?
Sure.
Well, I think it's sort of like a pop psychology, you know, advice to not to suppress the real things that are happening, or denial and all those kind of labels that we hear a lot. And so is there, is it just by, like if a sensual, like wanting a new car or some of the examples you've given, if that arises, is it just simply a practice of saying, nope, not going to go there, and you practice enough and pretty soon it doesn't come up? All right, what's the difference between suppressing in a way that it's still there but you're just not aware of it, you haven't discerned what's really there, motivating you, creating desires, versus a practice that becomes so skillful that it really isn't there anymore, doesn't have
power. Okay, what's going to happen is there going to be several stages in this practice. First one is say, one, recognize the difference between repressing and suppressing. Repressing is you deny. I never ever wanted that car. Don't ever say it. Okay, the suppressing is, okay, I know I want the car, but right now I can't think about it. Mm-hmm. And then while you're suppressing it, you will try to bring other things in to try to reason with yourself, like what a total waste of money it is, or that kind of stuff. And you say, you know, for the time being, I guess I really don't want that. Mm-hmm. And then tomorrow comes back. And you go through the list that worked today, and sometimes it'll work, and sometimes you say, I don't care, I don't want that car. And then you have to, and this is where the noisy part of the practice comes in, which is that, okay, why do you want a car? You say, oh, come on, I can't have a car. You know? Mm-hmm. It's hard enough being a human being. I can't have a car. And so then you start reasoning with yourself. Okay, what is it, what really about this? Why do you want this car? And why this car rather than a cheaper car? I mean, so what's wrong with the car you got? Mm-hmm. And you might actually come down to the conclusion that the car I've got really doesn't, you know, if I stick with it, I'm going to start losing extra money. So in order to save money, I should get a new car. In that case, you're saying, okay, that's not an unskillful desire. It's a reasonable desire. And the other times you realize, okay, it's just because I wanted that. I saw this ad for BMW one time, which just really turned me off. Mm-hmm. It's just this guy walking out to us in his parking lot, and there is his car, his BMW, and all the other cars, so you know, just junk. And he's got this and that's the person you want to take out and shoot. So you have to ask yourself, is that what you're going for? Is that the BMW frism? And so you sort of dig these things up. But the way you dig them up is by resisting them. It's like building a dam across a river. If you want to know how strong the current is in the river, try building a dam. And you'll find, oops, there are currents under there that I didn't know about. And that's what the purpose is. It's not by just denying yourself that it's going to go away. By denying yourself, you bring these things up. And then you can look at them. And sometimes when they come up to the surface, you say, oh my gosh, how do they ever? And it goes away fairly easily. Other times it requires a little more work, but there will come a point when you realize, you know, I really don't want that after all. And this is another one of the functions of mindfulness. Okay, you get the car. At the moment you're thinking about the pluses of this car. You say, Lord, what about the minuses? And part of your mind says, I don't want to hear about the minuses. I'm going to go for the pluses. We've got to look at the minuses. Yeah, the last time I was born, I did look at the fine print. Let's look at the fine print this time. Until you finally balance things out and say, okay, I really don't need this. I'm better off without it. Now, when you deal with, you know, lust, that's going to be a deeper problem. And one of the, and then you need lots of different tools, and one of the tools you're going to need is a sense of well-being that comes from concentration. So that the mind can be in a really calm, nourished, refreshed state of mind. Look at that lust and say, no. It's like certain kinds of food look good when you're hungry. But when you've, when you're off, it's like, how on earth? Like when I was a little kid, I always saved up my money because I wanted to buy Hostess Twinkies. Now the thought of a Hostess Twinkie is just... But that's, so it's, that's when you, you know, we're not dealing in repression, we're dealing with, okay, how do I cut through this thing? And sometimes you find that some of the things that take over your mind are things you can cut through pretty easily. It's just that you've let them for so long, that they've got the run of the place. Yes?
Well, if I were going to be asked to define mindfulness, I'd probably start with alertness as a synonym. So the distinction between the two...
Okay, the mindfulness is actually the things you keep in mind. Now we're doing this practice, we're combining alertness, mindfulness, and ardency. These are the three things we're going to be putting together. And I'll, we'll talk in a minute about why the alertness part suddenly got turned into mindfulness. And why that just kind of ran. As if it were the, what the whole practice was all about. But it's not the case. And would it, every place where the Buddha defines mindfulness in the canon, it's always quality of memory. Things you keep in mind. And then you try to keep that, you bear those things. Basically, it's the aspect of memory that's, what do they call it? Your active memory. What you're applying to the present moment right now. And then the ardency is what you are going to be doing with what you, you see is going on. Yes.
So then you're using mindfulness as kind of an active quality. It's kind of a central control place where you're taking these different pieces and drawing from them to be skillful, or being aware that you're not skillful and then turning it around to skillfulness. But it's an active quality, whereas awareness is maybe that's a step back from the mindfulness.
It's you're basically knowing what's going on in the present moment, and particularly you're focusing your attention on what am I doing.
Okay, so that's the watching mode. Is
that's the watching mode.
Okay.
And even there, though, you have to be careful to focus on the right spot.
Okay.
What am I doing right now?
So I'm going to try to clarify this question. So if you're meditating and you're seeing something, and it doesn't really have it's not in a form yet. It's a nebulous something that's there that's taking you away, but you don't know quite what it is. It's very subtle. Do you have to take it to the level of mindfulness to let it go, or can you just, I mean, what, you know, I've been just trying to let it go, but maybe I guess if I get stuck on it, I need to take it up to
if it keeps bit. Coming back, that's when you have to start bringing out your troops.
Okay.
But if it's saying, I don't know what this is, but I know it's negative, I just want to drop it. That's fine.
Okay. Okay, just let it dissipate,
yeah.
Whatever it is. Okay.
But if you find it, he's coming back and coming up, then you say, wait a minute, I've got a problem here. I've got to try to figure out what this is so
okay.
I can pull out whatever other tools I have.
Okay.
Yes?
Well, we're supposed to, well, two things is you can want to suffer from arising, though, if you can.
Yeah.
So you notice those that haven't arisen yet. Unarisen, those that are unarisen should not allow to arise.
Right.
And if they've arisen, then. But they're both hot potatoes.
They're both what?
Hot potatoes.
The hot potatoes, yes.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, like, I don't feel that you are going to deal with a hot potato any other way but to drop it. That's what you want to do. And you just drop it. You're not repressing it or suppressing it or expressing it. And anywhere on that dimension from unarisen or barely formative to arisen, you catch it anywhere you can.
Some of these problems are not hot potatoes. Hot potatoes coated in ice.
Hot head of what?
Coated in ice. They're coated in ice.
Yeah,
you pick it up. Hey, this is nice
and
cool.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm just a euphemism.
Yeah, no, but I mean, this is also an analogy for some things you don't recognize and want right away.
Something as cold as hot. If you hold too long, it's hot.
Yeah. And the problem is that you've been holding on to it.
Yes, that's so cool. Yes, I like that.
Let's deal with another analogy here. What would be better? Someone gives you a little present. He says, oh, I like presents. I'll take that home. And you take it, you've got it in your house, you open it up, and it's a snake. Now you've got a snake in your house. And so some of these, you can look at it and say, wait, what's in the box before I take it home? Yes.
Going back to compunction,
did I
understand correctly that would be otapa?
Otapa, yes.
And does hiri come into play here?
You can use that. I mean, we're talking about things that motivate us to do what's skillful and to avoid what's unskillful. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of ways you can motivate yourself. And hiri, which means shame, is one of them. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much the shame that comes, oh, I am a horrible person, but that action is beneath me. So you know, I'd be ashamed to do that. And that protects you from a lot of stuff.
And is that also to do with thinking about, if I did that, I'd really feel aki tomorrow.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's shame. That aki feeling. Anticipated akiness. Formal definition.